In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about the costs of war. And specifically here, what we're talking about is the war in Iraq, the war on terror, those kinds of efforts that we're involved in right now. And our guest for the program is Joshua Goldstein. He is, at the moment, adjunct professor at the Watson Institute for International Studies at Brown University, and has written on a number of subjects, including war, international relations, international political economy. He has a new book out, which is titled The Real Price of War, the subtitle How You Pay for the War on Terror. This book is published by the New York University Press, and if you'd like to read it, it's certainly out in bookstores and is available. And he makes the estimate in this book that the war on terror, as it is currently being funded, costs the average American $500 a month in taxes, budget cuts, increased national debt. In the book, he asks readers to imagine a government parking meter in their living room. She says every quarter you deposit buys America 20 minutes of national security. In the book, he makes the point that he thinks that it is very important that we fight the war on terror and that we win. And to do that, he says, it's going to require spending money. And in the book, he summarizes its main points this way in the introduction. He says, the real price of war makes three central arguments. First, that the war is more expensive than you thought, especially if you include hidden, indirect, and future costs. Second, he writes, we have little choice but to pay the price, and probably a rising price, in the coming years. And third, he writes, President Bush and the Congress have not been honest with the public about the real price of this war, which competes with tax cuts and other political priorities, so we still need a debate about how we split the bill for wars. He goes on to note, liberal readers will need to consider the possibility the war deserves even more money and attention than President Bush has given it. Conservative readers will need to consider the possibility that we need to raise taxes to pay for the war. Again, the book is titled The Real Price of War. Joshua Goldstein is talking with us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions, comments are welcome. Anybody can pick up the telephone and call, make a comment, ask a question. We do ask people to just try to be brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many callers as possible. But of course, anybody who's listening is welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Professor Goldstein, hello.
Hello, good to be with you.
Well, thanks very much for giving us your time. We certainly appreciate it. And I'm sure that that people hearing this little introduction that I've made and the fact that in the book you present this estimate, average American, $500 a month in taxes, budget cuts, increased national debt goes to the war on terror. I'm sure that a lot of people hearing that number will ask the question, and we can discuss it in some depth, how do you arrive at a figure like that?
Right. Well, that figure is actually more than just the war on terror and Iraq, and I'll tell you why. Hmm. There's a debate going on about the costs of the war in Iraq. The number $120 billion and counting has been used. First of all, we don't know what $120 billion is because, we're not used to thinking in those large numbers. So we want to translate that to what is it for the average household. And the formula is really pretty simple. If you take a $10 bill, that's $1 billion for the average household. It's about 100 million households. So your $120 billion would be 120 of those $10 bills, or $1,200 for the average household. That's how you can do the formula. Now, the problem is that number just for Iraq, which incidentally works out about $60 per month for the average household, that doesn't include the salaries of the soldiers serving there. It doesn't include their equipment and supplies. It doesn't include their research and development that lets them fight there. All those are in the regular Pentagon budget, and they are costs we have to pay to fight a war anywhere, but we're not talking about them yet. So when you add up the Pentagon budget, the supplementary spending for Iraq, and the other spending that we're doing in the war on terror, that's where you get to that overall figure, about $500 per household per month. That's what we spend on war. About a third of it is the increase since 9/11. So if you will, about $150 a month is just the war on terror, just the increase in the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. But without the rest of the two-thirds of it, we couldn't be doing any of the things we're doing in the war on terror. So that's why I'm trying to put the focus on the big number, the overall spending on war.
Right. Well, even though if we consider you say we have to look at this on a number of levels. You can look at spending specifically for what has come to be called the war on terror. So that's our cost for the Iraq war, for being in Afghanistan. You put in cost of homeland security there. And then if you look in a sort of a larger frame, you look at all of those things that go into maintaining the U.S. military and American defense capability that we would be doing just to make sure that it was there.
Some of it we would be doing anyway, and yeah. Others of it we wouldn't. For instance, veterans' benefits are not included in that $120 billion or $1,200 per household. But obviously we're going to pay more in veterans' benefits when we're fighting a war in Iraq and people are coming home wounded. So right now most of what we pay in veterans' benefits is for the last war, but in the future we'll have to pay for this war. Mm-hmm. So you have to put that on the table as a cost.
Then there, again, if you enlarge the frame, though, there are other costs that are related but perhaps indirect, not the kind of things that we immediately think of. It's not what we're spending on the war in Iraq. It's not homeland security. It's not maintaining the military. It's not veterans' benefits. It is related but hidden.
Right. There are the $500 a month, the 20 cents quarter in your parking meter for 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. That's only what the federal government spends. But when we're at war, there are a lot of privately paid costs and costs paid by state and local governments. I'll give you some examples. Champaign, Illinois has to do new things to protect against possible terrorist threats. They need more police officers. They need new decontamination equipment in their fire department, et cetera. Those are not paid by the federal government. That's paid by the local taxpayers. Hospitals need new kinds of equipment in case of a biological attack, and those are not paid by the federal government. That's in your health care premiums. The Golden Gate Bridge needs to be protected. It's a possible terrorist target. That's paid by a transit district sales tax surcharge. And so we're paying for the – and then businesses, private businesses, are paying a lot of costs for the increase of doing business in wartime, especially the hard-hit sectors such as the airline and transportation sectors. And then when the war goes badly, the price of oil goes up, and we all pay for that. So there's a lot of ways that we pay in addition to just what the government pays, and those are all in on top of the $500 a month bill that you're paying to the federal government.
So then if we ask this question, as the title of the book suggests, what is the real price of war, it's more than the average American is paying more than $5 a month, $500 a month. Have you got a number to put on it?
I don't have a number to put on it. A lot of it depends how the war goes, and it depends very much on how long the war goes on for. The longer a war goes on, the more these business disruptions and indirect costs pile up. And, of course, we don't know if the war will go badly and we'll have more terrorist attacks. Those are very expensive. Wars that go on more than a few years inevitably result in inflation. And inflation is a kind of hidden war tax that affects all of us as we pay more for everything. A long-term war, people talk about staying at war for a generation. This will lead to an escalation of all those costs and probably be paid primarily through inflation.
Looking at your background, your academic training is in political science, and
right.
The thing you have written about these things that I've talked about, things like the war and conflict and international relations and world order and so forth, including in political economy.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems that this is maybe a slight departure for you, that you're drifting over into the work of your colleagues who study economics. What led you to even want to do this analysis?
Well, it's not an economics book. It's really another example of what I've studied for decades, which is the impact of war on society. Mm-hmm. And in this case, the key issue, if you step back from the green eye shade, counting up the numbers aspect of this, which is not the most important thing. I mean, it's important to know that this is a lot more expensive than people are talking about. You step back from that, there's a basic dilemma here. I call it the self-evident truths of the war, which is the country's at war, it's very expensive, and somebody has to pay for it. You can't really argue with those propositions. When you think about how is somebody going to pay for it, you realize that the whole war effort is at odds with the philosophy of cutting taxes. We've never done it before in wartime. We've always raised taxes in wartime. we go to the wealthy Americans to pay for wars because that's where the money is. That's where most of the tax revenue comes from. And, for instance, in World War II, the top bracket income tax was 94%. I'm not advocating that now, but it shows that, you know, that's where we get the money in wartime. But this war is different. We're cutting taxes, especially for the wealthy, and then we're going off to war without adequate money to fight the war. That's the philosophical problem. Uh-huh. You have people who came into government committed to cutting taxes. Then we came into a war, and we needed to change that policy, but we haven't been able to do it yet.
And again, just to make sure that people know where you're coming from, you also make the strong arguments in the book, as I said, that the war on terror is important. It needs to be fought. It needs to be won. And it's expensive, so we need to spend what it takes to do it. It's just, as we've said, that you think that people should understand just what the cost is and that both the president and the Congress have not been straight about just how much it is going to cost. And does cost.
And just where we're going to get the money from. That's the debate we need to have. Where will this money come from if we're at war? And I do believe we need to pay for it and we need to prevail. It's going to be expensive, whether Kerry's president or Bush is president. It's going to be very expensive. So where will the money come from? And if you just have a blanket attitude that you'll never raise any tax on anything, in fact, you want to keep lowering taxes, then where is the money going to come from? Or how will we prevail in the war?
Well, let me again introduce our guest, and we have a couple of callers we'll get right to. We're talking with Joshua Goldstein. He's a political scientist. He is an adjunct professor at the Watson Institute for International Studies, which is at Brown University, and he's written a lot about war, conflict, international relations. His most recent book lays out some of the arguments that he has mentioned here already in the beginning part of the program. The title of the book is The Real Price of War, How You Pay for the War on Terror, and the book is published by the New York University Press. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a couple of people here ready to go. A caller in Indiana to start, line four. Hello.
Hello. Unfortunately, this is going to be one of those nebulous kind of questions, but where is the money going to come from? I can immediately think of, if Bush takes over, that welfare be cut pretty drastically and things like that. And if they keep up wanting to cut corporate taxes, capital tax, and tax on the wealthy, I presume they're going to hope that the Audis, the Saudis, and the rest of the world buy a lot of our bonds. And I'm just sort of like, you know, throwing this out. You know, I think of a number of ways it'll go. But from your studies of war and what's happened with economics, how do you sketch it as far as that goes?
Yeah, good question, and you're right on target. There's really only three places you can get money in wartime, unless you get the other countries to pay for it, as we did in the Gulf War, but we're not doing this time around. You can tax, you can cut the budget somewhere else, or you can just print up money. You know, literally run the printing presses is how they used to do it, but now it's a matter of just injecting extra money into the economy. And then you can also borrow, but when you borrow, you have to go around later and either tax, print, or cut somewhere else to pay for that, plus the interest. So those are the only ways we have to do it. And usually in wartime, we've done all of those things. This war, as I say, we're cutting taxes. We're not cutting much elsewhere in the budget, and it would be hard to do it in these quantities. And so most of it we're just borrowing and putting it off. Now, when we borrow that money, as you say, the foreign investors are the ones mostly buying that. And as they get less interested in investing in us because we're running up irresponsible deficits, then we have to pay them higher interest on that, and the costs go up. And ultimately, as I say, inflation, just if we just print up the money to pay for the war, as we've done in the past, then the money has less value, and it buys less, so that we're all paying more for inflation. This happened after World War I and World War II. The dollar lost about half its value and then a third of its value in those wars, but for this reason. And the difference between paying for it by an income tax and paying for it by inflation is the income tax hits mostly wealthy people. Inflation hits poor people the hardest. So there's a big philosophical issue about how we're going to pay for this. mostly rich people or mostly poor people? And that's the debate I want to have.
I think that there are some people who have made the criticism of the way the government's operated, at least for the past several decades, that when it comes time to confronting the guns or butter question, we say both. We want both. And that there are times when we're flush, the economy is doing well, that we can get away with that. But when not, what happens is we end up running up big deficits. Do you think that this administration, the place where we are now, are really any different when confronting that choice than past administrations have been?
Yeah, it is different because in the past, we've never been able to claim we would have both. We've always turned to all the sources that we could find in wartime. And we've been able to do it, especially the tax issue, raising taxes in wartime. We've been able to do that because Americans are willing to sacrifice in wartime when the country is under threat. And we've had political leadership in wartime, people like Roosevelt, who could call on the country to everybody sacrifice because we're in a time of need and because we need to win the war and as quickly as we can. This administration doesn't call on us to sacrifice. It calls on us to go shopping. It doesn't say we're going to win quickly, but rather it's just going to drag on and on. And then it's all just paid for by magic money, which is the money that we just borrow and have no plan to pay back, no plan to really bring down the deficits. So that's different. That hasn't happened before. Well, it happened one time somewhat similarly in the War of 1812. Congress declared war. They didn't pay for it, and they went home. And we had a disastrous series of military defeats until the government could finally get some money together, by which time Washington, D.C. had burned to the ground. So we don't want to do that again. It's better to have a plan and have the money and fight the war with the resources we need.
All right. Let's talk with some other people who are listening. The next caller in line is in Champaign and on line one. Hello.
Well, I'm just wondering, what are you calling the war on terror? As someone in international relations, what does it really consist of? Does it consist of keeping people out of the country who are moderate leaders in Europe, like Cat Stevens and who's also known as Yusuf Islam or Tariq Ramadan? Or I guess, you know, I'm just wondering, we had people talking about the new American century, and I don't think that it's going to turn out the way the neocons had planned, and that the world is changing, whether it's culturally, which maybe people like Yusuf Islam or Tariq Ramadan might represent in some way, or they might be the mirror images of those people who think that we need to do something about our secular society and liberalism and turn to religion. It's just that they want to turn to another religion, and maybe that's why they're being blocked from coming into this country to discuss religious and cultural ideas at places like Notre Dame. But anyway, the world is changing culturally, economically, strategically. Is it just a simple war? It doesn't seem like it's anything like any previous war that we've fought, and it's very nebulous. So could you maybe clarify some of those issues?
Sure. It is a different kind of war than we fought before. You can argue about whether war is even the best word for it. To my mind, there are a lot of people killing each other in various places in the world, and that looks like a war to me. My book is not about how we fight the war. So my argument is, whether you think it was a good idea to go into Iraq or a bad idea to go into Iraq, personally, it was a bad idea, I think. But whichever way you come down on that question, it's going to be very expensive. And you can't rewind history and say, let's not have the war in Iraq. We're there. We're, you might say, bogged down there. It's very expensive, and it will be whoever is president. Afghanistan, we never finished the job there. One of my arguments is that we didn't spend enough money to do a good job in any of these places. We're trying to fight the war on the cheap for what the administration said they were trying to accomplish. And then Homeland Security is unfinished and needs more resources. Container cargo system and those kinds of things are not getting the resources that they need. So there are a series of these things, and I've more or less accepted the administration's framing of this as these are related efforts. They're concerned with protecting us from al-Qaeda and terrorist attacks, whether some of them were mistakes in trying to do that, we can talk about. But the efforts that they're making are in a variety of places and a variety of kinds of efforts, but they're trying to do them on the cheap because they don't want to give up the tax cuts. So I can give you a whole series of examples from Homeland Security to Afghanistan, Iraq, and so forth, how they have done these things on the cheap and how, with adequate resources, they might have had better luck with what they were trying to do.
Right, but that seems just the tip of the iceberg, the actual terror and violence in the world. But the whole way that this is playing among the people, the world's populations, and the way that it's polarizing the world, I mean, I don't know how we can draw back and somehow not have this polarization. But it seems like it's an absolutely, it's like a snowball out of control.
Yep. It's a mess now, and an expensive mess. I talk about three fronts, if you want to call them that, three ways that we're fighting the war, if you call it a war, I do. One is military actions. Another is homeland security, all those things about our port security and borders and critical infrastructure, the food system, et cetera. And then the third is foreign aid and diplomacy. That's where we're trying to win friends and influence people around the world. And that's important in this war because the terrorists are in a bunch of countries. We need the support of and help of the people in those countries and the governments of those countries. And obviously, this is a terrible time for in terms of our friends in the world supporting us. The public opinion polls are just depressing about people's views of America. And I make the point that for the kinds of money that we're spending in Iraq, for example, we could take on big public health initiatives, stopping the AIDS epidemic and things like that, that would really show some leadership to the countries of the world, address some of the problems of inequality, poverty in the world, and it would be cheaper than some of the military actions that we take. But whether you think the emphasis of the war should be military actions or should be foreign aid and diplomacy or should be homeland security or all three, you're still in for a lot of spending to dig your way out of the hole that we're in now.
Well, let me first of all, I want to thank the caller and say we're at our midpoint here, and I have some other people I want to get to. But let me ask the direct question, because a little bit earlier you said, well, look at what we've done in the past when we've been in similar situations. There are a number of things that you can do. You can raise taxes. You can increase the money supply, or you can divert spending from somewhere else and put it into defense. And you said in the past, we've often done all of these things. And the big problem here is that we really haven't done any of them. And we've talked about just how much it does cost the average American to support the American defense establishment and to carry out this thing that we call the war on terror.
Right.
You're proposing that what we really need to do is actually to spend more. Is it possible to do some of that by reallocating where we spend? Or really, at the end of the day, are we talking about we're going to have to spend more and that means that we're going to have to get that from taxes? We're going to have to raise taxes.
I don't see any way to do it without raising tax or without at least rolling back some of the tax cuts of the last few years, put it that way. The money isn't there any other way. And my proposal, it's not really a proposal so much as a thought experiment, that I say, given that the war has been underfunded in these various areas, we could talk more about them. What could we do with an extra, suppose we went from $500 a month to $600 a month per household, how much money would that give us and what would it let us do better than we're doing now? And it turns out it would dramatically improve our ability to carry out homeland security. For example, on these container cargo containers coming into the country, 20,000 a day coming in, and it would cost less than $1 billion to put sensors in them to secure them so that we know what's coming in those containers. This is a system that has been thought about and could be done, but we just don't have the money for it right now. Give you another example from Iraq. We went to buy up shoulder-fired missiles in Iraq because they pose a grave danger to commercial aviation in the hands of terrorists. And we said, we'll give a reward of $500 per missile if you turn these things in. There were thousands of them that Saddam Hussein had. And it turns out that on the black market, you can get $5,000 a missile for these things. So we're just underpaying, and we didn't get very many of those turned in. Or in Afghanistan, we went to form a national army, and we paid them $1 a day. the soldiers. And that's the UN's definition of extreme poverty in poor countries. So, and most of them quit because they weren't paid enough to support their families. So if you're going to have expansionist rhetoric, you know, if rhetoric were money, the war would be well funded. But if you're going to have this expansionist rhetoric, you go around the world and try to do big things to grapple with the terrorist threat, then you've got to fund them adequately to make them work. And if we had this spirit of let's pay $600 instead of $5, get the job done, and get back to peacetime, to my mind, that's much wiser than always being late and, you know, a day late and a dollar short, and then ending up with the war dragging on year after year and decade after decade, causing immense damage to the economy as you go.
Let me, I promise the callers you're holding will get right to them. But let me ask one further question that goes to the debate over taxes that's been going on now here between President Bush and Senator Kerry. President Bush, when he was running for election the first time, and he laid out his agenda, it seemed that the top thing, the most important thing, as far as he was concerned, was cutting taxes. And he got it. He got his tax cut. And he has continued to say that he thinks that that was the right thing to do, that that's the way to stimulate the economy. He would like to see the tax cuts made permanent. So he continues to defend that position. Senator Kerry says, no, that's the wrong way to go, because the tax breaks have gone to the wealthiest Americans. And he says what he would do if elected is that he would raise taxes on the wealthiest people, continuing to look out after the interests of the middle class. He's also said some things about possibly that he can make some changes in the taxes that fall on corporations, and that would generate additional money. And he has a number of things that he says that he would spend that money on. Now, the president says, well, they have competing numbers where they say how much money, additional money, would be generated by increasing the tax on wealthy Americans. But it's hard to, even if Mr. Kerry is right, it's hard to see that the additional money that would generate is really going to cover everything that he's talked about doing.
Right. That would be my criticism of Senator Kerry, that he at least is flexible about that we need to raise more money and not just keep borrowing magic money. But he's not really talking about putting that into the war effort so much as health care and other areas. The president, by contrast, is so rigid about never raising taxes that he was unable to change. I guess, you know, changing his position is not his strong point. But he came into office, got the tax cuts, fine, and then came September 11th. The country was united behind him. We were all willing to make sacrifices, and that was his chance to say, I promise to cut taxes, but we're going to have to turn some of that back now because we're at war. But he couldn't do it. So that's where I see a lack of leadership, to call on people that we all are in this together. We're going to need to sacrifice. We're going to need the country united. And instead, the country has become bitterly divided again. We're distracted from the war effort. And frankly, I think it'll take another big terrorist attack, which everybody thinks will happen sooner or later, to get us back to realizing we're at war and we need to grapple with these issues.
It's very difficult to imagine any candidate running for anything getting up in front of potential voters and saying, I'm going to raise taxes.
It's not even easy going on the radio and talking about it.
But I guess that's...
You know, are we going to go back to a 94% marginal rate like World War II? The political discourse in the country doesn't even let you talk about those things. Well, luckily, if you're a professor and you're writing a book, you can raise these issues, and I think we need to raise them. We need to talk about them. But probably it'll be after the election that anybody would take that seriously, for the reason that you say. You'd be dead in the election if you go in promising to raise taxes.
Well, I have several callers. We'll get right to them. Let me just take enough time to introduce again the guests for this hour of Focus 580. Joshua Goldstein is a political scientist. He's written a lot about war, conflict, international relations. He is adjunct professor at the Watson Institute for International Studies at Brown University, and previously held tenure at University of California and also at American University in Washington, D.C. He's author of a number of books, and the most recent is The Real Price of War, How You Pay for the War on Terror, and it's published by New York University Press. Back to the phones here. Urbana next, and that is line number two. Hello.
Yeah, hi. You said that we haven't been told about all the expenses for research and in the military for the war, but then on the other hand, we've had this war in Iraq, and now the the military contractors are going to turn around and use that as an excuse to get more funding.
Yep. And this is the exception to the rule that I stated, which is that war is bad for business and bad for the economy. Well, it's not bad for all business, in truth. If you bought Halliburton stock 2 years ago, you've doubled your money. And obviously, military contractors do better in wartime. They make more money. But you don't want to generalize that to say that corporations do better, that corporate America does better in wartime. That's not true. For every military contractor like Halliburton, there are a lot of big companies like Boeing that are, Boeing does some military contracting, but on their civilian side, they're really hurting. The airlines going into bankruptcy, everybody who depends on the price of oil, which is all the manufacturing companies, are hurting from it. So there are winners and losers, but there are more losers than there are winners in corporate America.
Yeah, I'd like to say just two things quickly before I hang up.
Sure.
First of all, China and Japan have both been buying literally trillions of dollars of United States debt. Right. The total federal debt is $7 trillion, and about $3 or $4 trillion of that is owed to those two countries. And I don't understand why tax and spend is better than borrow and spend. The United States is becoming a global laughingstock due to our being indebted to the rest of the world. And like you said, the money supply has been growing by 10% per year, which is basically creating paper money or computer money out of thin air, and decreases the value of the money in people's savings accounts.
Exactly.
And just one more thing, a lot of times you hear, well, these numbers are so big that nobody can deal with them. If you want to convert trillions of dollars into dollars per household, take the number of trillions and multiply by 10,000. So a $10 trillion federal debt is $70,000 per family, per household, like you said. And actually, that's a conservative number because you're assuming an average household size of three people, whereas if you consider a family of four with one or two surviving grandparents, that's actually more like about 50,000 family or 50 million families that has one or two wage earners. So the actual federal debt is more like $100,000 to $150,000 per family, and to that you have to add on people's mortgages, credit card, consumer debt, which could get up toward like a quarter of $1 million.
Right.
So it just seems like we are spending way, way too much money on wars. And the whole rhetoric about tax and spend is just not nearly as bad as the borrowing that we've been doing. Anyway, thanks a lot.
All right.
Yeah, your numbers are right. It's about $70,000 debt per average household, and that formula that I mentioned earlier is the same that you just said 1,000 times bigger, which is that $1 billion is a $10 bill for the average household. So $1 trillion would be $10,000 for the average household. The federal debt has gone up by $20,000 or so per average household on President Bush's watch. So that's your share of it. And the interest that the average household is paying on the national debt is now up to almost $300 a month. That's just the interest, and that's going up fast. And clearly, if China and Japan stop being so interested in buying our Treasury securities, then we'll have to pay more interest, and that number is going to go up quite steeply.
All right, let's talk with someone else. This also is an Urbana listener, line number three. Hello.
Hello. I would submit this, that worrying about how we pay for this war is perhaps useless until we decide what the war is and who we're fighting. The term war on terrorism is meaningless. Terrorism is simply a tactic used by actually a number of, at least in the past, disparate groups. And we better decide which ones we're actually fighting. For instance, the Chechens are Muslims, but they were not fundamentalists, and at least until quite recently had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. They're nationalists. The same thing could be said for the civil war in Pakistan, which perhaps is ending, had nothing to do with fundamentalist Islam, but certainly had a lot to do with terrorism. One could probably say the same about the Palestinians, who are certainly not fundamentalists, and whom probably for that reason, until quite recently, Al-Qaeda showed very little interest in.
Right.
So, and of course, then we're fighting a war in Iraq, which wasn't a religious nation anyway. This was a secular nation, and one that Al-Qaeda was particularly determined to bring down. We're going to waste a lot of money over the next few years unless we understand who we're fighting and what they are.
Well, we're going to spend that money in the next few years anyway, because...
we are now, yes.
But whether Kerry's elected or Bush is elected, we're there in Iraq. I think, you know, the one thing they agree on, and I agree with them, is you can't just pull out precipitously without causing a worse problem and destabilizing the region that is really the source of the terrorist
threat. Unfortunately, I suspect we're destabilizing it if we stay.
And
the question is, are we destabilizing it more if we stay or if we get out?
Well, we are destabilizing it, staying or getting out, maybe. But my point is, there's no cheap, easy solution to this, and you can't just say, well, we don't need to worry about the problem. We do need to worry about the problem, and that problem of terrorist groups of global reach, that's not the Hamas people, but Qaeda, you know, getting their hands on nuclear weapons, which they're trying hard to do.
And may have done.
Have some capability. That's a very real problem, and we need to focus on it. Now, the fact that we botched an operation in Iraq, ended up making things worse, et cetera, that's all in the past now. Now we have to pay our way out of that problem.
My point is, if we continue doing things like Iraq, we make things worse, and we're very ineffective in ending the problem. We've got to understand what the objectives of Al-Qaeda are, and I suspect that they have very little to do with us in the long term, that this is really an internal struggle in Islam. The fundamentalist against probably 90% of the rest of Islam. And I hate to say this, but I believe that our blundering in Iraq has greatly furthered bin Laden's aims.
That's right. So now if you put yourself in the White House and decide what to do about it in the next 4 years, you want to make a fresh start, you want to do things differently, but you're surely going to need a lot of money to do it right now.
Absolutely. And when we say long term, people seem to think 4, 5, 10 years. I'd point out that the Egyptians have been fighting the Muslim Brotherhood for 70 years.
Yeah, people talk about a new 30 years war. If you go study the 30 years war, 1618 to 1648 in Europe, it was a disaster. Certainly economically, killed off a third of the population in Central Europe, epidemic diseases, poverty, just ruination of those societies. So this is not something you want to have as another 30 years war.
Okay, I'm going to jump in here because the lines are full. And again, I want to get in some other folks. We are into our last 15 minutes. So we'll go next to a Champagne caller and line one. Hello.
Yes, thank you. Everything you've had to say today has just reinforced something I've been arguing for some time, that not only is Bush and company bankrupting the United States, but they're accelerating the decline of the American empire. And, you know, you could argue whether or not that may be good for the rest of the world. I think it almost certainly will mean much harder times here at home. If you read the writings of people like Bill Kristol and Paul Wolfowitz, they believe that U.S. military power can be used to maintain our economic dominance in the world and keep things, you know, better here. But I'm very skeptical about that, and I certainly think it's immoral. They are really setting us up, I think, for an incredible economic decline. in the next few years to decades.
Yeah, I think it's an overstatement to say that it'll bankrupt us unless there's a big, a terrorist nuclear attack on several cities or something like that. But the road we're on now, it'll weaken us. It'll drain our economy. It'll make us all poorer. But we are a big, rich country. And, the war spending is still just 5-6% of our gross domestic product. And it's a cost that we could absorb if we were sensible about how to pay for it, if we had the country united about what we're doing, and if it were for a short period of some years, not going on decade after decade. It's something we can do financially. It's not that costs don't need to be prohibitive, but we're not going about it the right way.
Well, but Bush is talking about further cuts in taxes, and which will mean more borrowing, and what if the rest of the world decides that the dollar isn't worth much anymore?
Then you're going to get something similar to what happened in the Vietnam War financially, which is that we had low inflation in the early 60s, just like now, 1% a year, 0.5%, 1.5% a year. And then comes the Vietnam War, and then we saw very high inflation. And it turned into stagflation, where the economy wasn't really growing. There was high inflation. People's standard of living was going down, as it started to now. Now, the war is not responsible for all these problems, but it does make all of them worse, right down to the local school district that's not getting its money because the local police department needs the money because of threats in Homeland Security, and it isn't being paid by the federal government because of the federal tax cuts. It kind of trickles down to cuts that hit us in our local communities. Some of that would happen without the war, but it's making all those problems worse.
Well, I'm very wary of, where we're going, and I think that, your work's very important, and I hope that you can get this, understood by a wider part of the population, because I think a lot of people seem to have their heads stuck in the sand in this country right now.
Thank you. There's a website for the book at realpriceofwar.com, so people can read the first chapter there if you...
Thank you.
All right, let's go to Bloomington, Indiana, line 4 for the next. Hello.
Hi. May I name 4 ways that we are fighting terrorism and ask you how we could pursue these ways of fighting terrorism for less money?
Yep.
First way we're fighting terrorism, we're on the offensive. You go on the offensive and you keep the terrorists on the run, because it's hard for terrorists to attack when they're running for their life.
Right.
How could we do that for less?
I don't think we should do it for less. I think that we tried to do it for less in Afghanistan. We had the terrorists on the run. We had our forces near them, and we held back and let the Afghan warlords do it instead, which turned out to be a disastrous mistake. Al-Qaeda was able to regroup and come back worse than ever because of that. It's an example of penny wise and pound foolish.
There's a pretty good military argument for allowing people to maneuver in rough mountains, which our soldiers don't know anything about those mountains, never been in them,
yep.
And those native people have been there, they know them, and that's a pretty good military strategy to let those people maneuver in those mountains that they know about.
Well, it didn't work.
Well, I know, but it's still good military strategy.
And then in Iraq, we went on the offensive, and whatever you think about whether it was a good idea or not, we needed more troops. I think that's clear now. Paul Bremer has said it, that we needed more troops there to keep order on the ground, to stop the looting and to stop the insurgency from taking hold. And now we're stuck there with a bigger job than we should have had we gone in the first place with the adequate resources.
Let me go to the second way of fighting terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
The second way of fighting terrorism is to put potential terrorists in Guantanamo where they can't commit terrorism. How can we do that for less?
No answer on that. I think that what we're doing there, we have enough of a budget for.
Okay. Third way of fighting terrorism, we convert states which are friendly to the terrorists to states which are friendly to us. In other words,
right.
As we're doing in Iraq, we make a friendly base out of a base that was friendly to the terrorists.
Yep. If it worked, it would be a good idea. We did it in Afghanistan, and certainly I supported that. overthrowing the Taliban there, which had been directly harboring al-Qaeda, our enemy. Iraq is a little bit different case. But the problem in Afghanistan, to go back to the money issue, we overthrew the government, and then we did not provide countrywide security because we wanted to go into Iraq and get our troops out of Afghanistan and because we didn't want to pay for it. Don Rumsfeld had a news conference in early 2002 where he was asked what would it take to provide countrywide security, and he said it'd take money, but we don't have it. And they said, where are you going to get it from? And he said, gosh, when it comes to money, I'll take it wherever I can get it. That's not how you fight a war. You give the Secretary of Defense the money that he needs to secure the countryside in Afghanistan if that's what we need to do to keep it from turning into a terrorist haven again. But we didn't do that, and some say we were distracted.
We wanted to
go into Iraq, but it didn't happen.
The fourth and final way that I think we're fighting terrorism might be a way that we could save a lot of money. If we can disrupt the funding and communications of the terrorists, that is to say, if we can take the funding away from them, we don't have to spend so much to fight them, do we?
You need to spend something to go in and take the money away from them and disrupt
right.
their networks. And if you read what people are writing who were in the government, who were the counterterrorism people, Richard Clark and people like that, they will tell you that there's not enough money, there's not enough resources, the administration is not giving them what they need to succeed. And they end up like, I say in the book, they're like light bulbs. We just screw them in, burn them out, and then screw another one in. There's a tremendous turnover of counterterrorism officials, and it's a sign that they're not getting what they need to get the job done and to make it work. It's all an indication that this is not well thought through and not adequately funded, and that the country's not united behind it because of the way we're going about it.
Well, I certainly wouldn't say that we haven't made any mistakes, but I would say this is the first time, I guess, in world history that we've ever fought a war against terrorism,
mm-hmm.
and since 9/11, we have not had a substantial terrorist attack on our own U.S. soil. We must be doing something right.
Well, yeah, or there's, as we know, a long time lag between Qaeda attacks. They'll often wait 5 or 6 years and then come back and hit a target again, so you don't want to be lulled by the fact that we haven't been hit again. Everybody who studies al-Qaeda, everybody who's in the government fighting this fight will tell you that there's a real danger that things are not going as well as you would think from the fact that we haven't been attacked again. It could happen again anytime, and it's very likely to happen again sometime.
Well, I'm trying to get one more caller here in Chicago, line 2. Hello.
I think a lot of the previous callers have all pointed to the fact that this definition of war and terror doesn't have any shape to it. And I think it's very hard to pull in public support and commitment if it's shapeless. At least two previous callers have spoke to that. But my problem is that I think you're seriously underestimating how long we'll be battling a war on terror. I mean, if you look at Ireland, that's going to come close to the century mark pretty soon. And in Spain, a fight with ETA has been more than 30 years. And in both those cases, that only came into a reasonable conflict with the use of diplomacy. And we have a policy of not talking, not negotiating. And I think that means that we're talking about an endless war on terror, because I haven't seen any case where terrorism has been resolved without a political solution.
Well, I do agree with you that the timeline we're on now, it looks like it's going to be an endless war because we're going backward as much as we are forward. But that doesn't mean it has to be an endless war, and I don't think Ireland would really be the right analogy for this war. But I do make a...
That's the question. What is the analogy for this war? Because it has no shape. And
well, let's take the analogy for a second of World War II. So that was a completely different kind of war, but it was obviously a much greater threat to us. This is a war that killed tens of millions of people, and the entire world was wrapped up in it. We were facing Nazi Germany with all of Europe under occupation, virtually. And yet, from the time that Pearl Harbor was attacked until the final surrender of Japan in that war, was a time period equivalent to the time from 9/11 to the middle of next year. Now, when we get to the middle of next year, we're not going to be signing a ultimate surrender of Japan kind of end of the war. We're just getting started. So we're going about it much slower. And I think it's the president's job to mobilize and unify the country behind a vision of the war that people understand. And he's failed to do it so far. But given political leadership that would define the war in a way we understand, tell us what we need to do to win it, and not in 30 years, but maybe five, and what resources are needed and where we're going to have to pay for it, I believe the American people would rally behind that and that we could get the job done. There's nothing inherently impossible about finding al-Qaeda, rooting them out, and putting them out of business. It can be done.
We must stop there because we're here at the end of the time. I want to say to anybody who's interested, again, in reading some more of the thoughts of our guest, you can look for the book that we mentioned. It's titled The Real Price of War. It's published by New York University Press. And as Professor Goldstein has mentioned, also there's a website for the book where you can read the first chapter and some other things about it, which is realpriceofwar.com. Otherwise, you can head down to the bookstore and look for the book. And again, our guest, Joshua Goldstein, is an associate of the Watson Institute for International Studies at Brown University and has authored a number of books dealing with war, conflict, and international relations. Professor Goldstein, thanks very much for talking.
My pleasure.